Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo. And we've got a fascinating subject to talk about today. Many of you, I'm sure, have seen the movies with the well-known actors that played Men in Black. And it was just a hoot because it was phenomenally well done. But we're going to be talking about the Men in Black in real life, in real time. My guest today is Nick Redfern. And Nick, I want to welcome you to the show.
Well, thanks, Donna. Thanks for having me on the show again.
Well, it's a delight. Now, I want my audience to know that writing is very much a part of your life. You travel, you lecture, you write for a number of different magazines. You've already had more than one book published, and you've been featured on the History Channel's Monster Quest and UFO Hunters, also on National Geographic's Paranatural, which I thought was very interesting, and Sci-Fi Channel's Proof Positive. Nick, this book, The Real Men in Black, why did you decide, I mean, you have written the NASA conspiracies, why was this significant to you? What was it that made you say, gee, I've got to put something in print about this? Why?
Well, I think one of the main reasons, Donna, was because, you know, as an author, when you write books and people read them, they often contact you with their own experiences. You know, they either want help or advice on, you know, how to deal with them or who to speak to. And over probably the last 10 years or so, you know, various books having been written, as I was going through my emails and files one of the days about two years ago now, I began to realize that I'd got a large number of Men in Black type stories that had never ever been seen before. And a lot of people were just assuming or thinking that the Men in Black mystery was just a very old mystery, you know, the one sort of primarily focused in the 40s, 50s, and 60s that had then gone away. But the reality is that the sightings and incidents are certainly no less today than they were 50 years ago. And so I thought, well, you know, why not try and, you know, bring this new material to a new audience, but also to the old audience as well, and demonstrate this is still ongoing, and go back and readdress some of the earlier classic cases, and then also look at the different theories and really try and do sort of an updated roundup of the mystery and bringing it up to literally like 2009, 2010. So,
you have right at the very beginning of your book a fascinating introduction, and it was from an experience of a woman by the name of Helen, who lives in Cannock Chase, and this was in 1994, so we're not talking about a long time ago, really. What happened with her? Share with my audience what her experience was, because that's what you lead off with in the book.
Yeah, that's, you know, when I talk about cases that sort of reach my attention, this was one of the early ones. This goes back to the 1990s. My first book didn't come out till 97, and this was 94. Or thereabouts when I interviewed Helen. And the Cannock Chase is a large area of forest land in central England, and sort of a very spooky place, and it has a long history of weird activity and strange phenomena. And she and her husband were coming home late one night and had a UFO sighting, or they assumed it was just like a UFO sighting. But then in the days and nights that followed, in the immediate week afterwards, both her and her husband had strange dreams about the car sort of malfunctioning and breaking down in the middle of the woods, and these strange little creatures surrounding the car. So it was almost like an alien abduction experience with a screen memory put in place, if you like, that started to come out through Helen's subconscious. And after having these dreams that one particular day knock on the front door, you know, just wondered if perhaps it was the mailman, you know, dropping something off. But it was this sort of weird-looking little guy, about 5 feet tall, dressed in a black suit and hat, you know, sort of a very old-style black suit and hat, you know, that looks straight out of the 1950s, like a fedora-type hat. And He had this sort of very thin stature, very pale-faced, almost looking anemic, and basically didn't make himself very clear. And that's something that we find in a lot of these MIB experiences, that they kind of stumble over their words. They're almost robotic and zombie-like. And she said that the man essentially gave like a veiled message not to talk about UFOs, and you know, but he kind of couched it in odd terms, you know, along the lines of, "We understand you've had a strange experience. You know, it's probably best not to talk about it." That sort of thing. And Helen said to me quite openly, you know, she got this really strange vibe from this man. You know, that unnerved her. She couldn't really understand why. It was sort of, he was just sort of exuding menace, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
And she started actually to feel dizzy and unwell. And she put this down actually to this man, if that's what he was, you know, his presence. And the overall experience really sort of chilled Helen to the bone, and to the point where, you know, it was clearly a definitive Man in Black encounter, but she got sort of a distinct feeling that, you know, was this man, if that's what he was, even human? You know, was it some sort of paranormal or UFO-related entity? But this is sort of a classic case of what we get in the Men in Black mystery, are these sort of creepy, pale-faced characters that just turn up on the doorstep and intimidate people.
Well, I know in the movie that was really a comedy, in a mm-hmm. sense, that was done by Will and Tommy Lee Jones. Mm-hmm. When I reflect on having seen that, I thought it was, you know, vivid imagination. There, yet, you talk about how they usually appear within the amount of three, and mm-hmm. they usually drive 1950-style black Cadillacs,
mm-hmm.
and in the British Isle, which is interesting, 1960-era black Jaguars, and they always look like they're brand new.
Yeah.
And they have a black suit, black fedora or Homburg style hat, mm-hmm. black sunglasses, black necktie, black socks, black shoes, and a very crisp shining white shirt. And that's just fascinating to me. Now, what's even more interesting to me is that you say Albert Bender
mm-hmm.
is the one that really started mm-hmm. a lot of the awareness regarding this, but in your book, you go through chronological periods, and he starts with 1945. Tell us about Albert Bender. Who is he?
Mm-hmm. Well, Albert Bender was someone who, like a lot of people in the United States and all around the world, in the post-Second World War era, when the flying saucer wave kicked off in 1947, Bender got interested and fascinated by UFOs. But he was someone who, even back during the war and earlier, had a fascination with the occult and the paranormal, both in the world of reality and fiction. For example, he was quite heavily into Ouija boards and spiritualism and paranormal phenomena, but he was also sort of steeped in literary gothic novels, people like Bram Stoker, Edgar Allan Poe, and horror writers like H.P. Lovecraft.
Mm-hmm.
And he gravitated towards the UFO subject as well, and in 1952, Bender set up an organization called the International Flying Saucer Bureau, which is, you know, it's kind of like many of the UFO groups that exist in the U.S. today. But Bender's IFSB, it actually took off hugely, probably far more than even Bender himself ever anticipated. And chapters were set up in Australia, in England, and elsewhere. And Bender quite literally found himself answering mail night after night, you know, that the mailman would drop off by the sack load almost. And so in other words, very, very quickly, the IFSB mutated from just a little group in the town Bridgeport, Connecticut, where Bender lived, into a worldwide group with strands and networks all over the place. And this was made even more significant by the fact that at the height of the group's success, quite literally out of the blue, Bender closed the group down and just said that there were reasons why he was closing the group, and one day he would perhaps tell the story, or maybe he wouldn't. Now, at the time, some people thought, well, this is just like a publicity ploy to, you know, get more publicity for his group. But that didn't turn out to be the case. Bender really did vanish from the UFO scene and just backed away. And he actually only resurfaced again very, very briefly in 1962 when he wrote a book called Flying Saucers and the Three Men, which was essentially his account of how and why he set the group up and how why it came to be closed down. And Bender tells a very strange story about how, at the height of the IFSB's research, he started to get the feeling that he was being watched and followed. There would be sort of strange phone calls at the house, crackling and interference on the telephones, and just, you know, just people just, you know, they would answer the phone, either him and his, or his stepfather, and there wouldn't be anybody on the phone, but they'd have this sort of sensation that there was somebody there, you know, just not speaking. And he talked about how when he used to go to the cinema on a Saturday night, he was a big fan of horror movies and sci-fi movies, and he would walk back through the sort of dark streets of Bridgeport, and he would see these sort of shadowy figures, as he described them, with these glowing eyes sort of lurking menacingly in the shadows and watching him. And it kind of comes across like a gothic horror story, you know, as if rather than dealing with men in black, they're almost vampire-type creatures, sort of predatory supernatural entities. And it culminated with when Bender said one particular evening he was in the bedroom and started to feel ill and dizzy and lightheaded. So he lay down and he felt his mind kind of going to like an altered state of perception. And he said suddenly these three men in black-type characters literally kind of manifested in the bedroom and made their way towards him in sort of a creepy, you know, uniform motion and surrounded him. And then he felt that he essentially fainted, and he had this sort of visionary experience of the men in black telling him the truth about the UFO mystery and why he should leave the subject. And so that in sort of, you know, boiled down terms is the story of Albert Bender. But it's kind of ironic that the man who really gave birth to the Men in Black and was responsible for the, by default, for the coining of the term Men in Black, his experience was nothing like in the movies, you know, with where in the movies they're kind of the secret agents of a classified government group. In reality, Bender's Men in Black sound like they walk straight out of, you know, as I said, some sort of gothic horror novel rather than, you know, out of the Pentagon, shall we say.
Fascinating stuff. Now, there is so much that is talked about behind the scenes. Cover-ups are quite common with government. But before I go into something of that dispositioning, Brad Steiger became very much involved in this, and this was in the 60s.
Yes.
Brad Steiger is known for his elusive, etheric, fantasy areas of thinking that are just quite phenomenal. How did he get involved with all this?
Well, the interesting thing about the Men in Black is that although they've been around since at least the 50s and possibly earlier than that, and some people even push it back centuries, but it seems to come in waves. And certainly the late 40s to mid 50s, when Bender was around, then that was a height of, you know, activity in the 50s. Then it kind of died off from sort of 56, 57, but resurfaced again around about 65, 66. And this is when Brad got involved, and because I know Brad quite well, and so I said, you know, I'm writing this book. Can I, you know, do an interview with you and get your views on record as to, you know, what was going on in that period? Because I always feel, not just for giving something new to the reader, but also, you know, if there are people who are still around now who are around back then, it's better to go direct to them than just, you know, take it from second or third hand sources. And Brad told me a number of cases that he had investigated or been involved in that were related to the Men in Black. And what was interesting was that, as he told me, some of his friends who had either had UFO experiences or were interested in the subject, they kind of received visits from the Men in Black who, in some cases, kind of issued threats indirectly to Brad. For example, one of Brad's friends was on holiday in London in the mid-60s. And while he was there, you know, he did the whole tourist thing. And he said that repeatedly he would see these three weird Men in Black following him or just kind of watching him from a distance, you know, on the tube station platform or whatever. And he described them as, again, being quite short and skinny and having these oddly wide-set eyes. And it kind of, you know, really intimidated and disturbed Brad's friend. And he said it kind of culminated where one night He was in the apartment he was staying in, or the hotel in London, looked out the window, and there were these three men in black staring up at the window. And then the next day, when he went out, they confronted him, and they said something along the lines of, "You're a friend of Brad Steiger, aren't you?" And he said, "Well, yes." And they said, "Tell him we will visit him at Christmas time," which kind of sounds a bit ominous, you know. Mm-hmm. But fortunately, Brad didn't get a visit. But, you know, it was one of these situations where it did come across as quite intimidating. And I think the most interesting thing for me that Brad told me was how, when he got to know John Keel, you know, John was a very acclaimed author, wrote a number of very well-received and legendary books like The Mothman Prophecies and Operation Trojan Horse. And Keel had been chasing down the men in black all across the U.S., and particularly at Point Pleasant, West Virginia, when the Mothman sightings were at their height and men in black were being seen all around town. And Brad told me how when he and Keel were having dinner one night in the 60s, Keel confided in him that he'd had a man in black encounter, or men in black encounter, that was very similar to Albert Bender's, where he said that these three guys, again a trio of them, literally kind of manifested through the woodwork of the front door of Keel's apartment and, you know, sort of drifted into the room in kind of spectral form and then sort of reconstituted into sort of a full physical 3D reality. And if you read Keel's books, you can tell he's clearly obsessed with the Men in Black mystery and resolving it. And, you know, with hindsight, I think when Brad told me this story about how Keel said, you know, he'd had this experience where they kind of literally appeared phantom-like through the door, it clearly had a major influence on Keel, I think. And, you know, Brad was sort of full of stories like this about how either he'd been told of experiences or, you know, by default people had sort of threatened him, you know, but through his friends, so to speak.
Fascinating story. Now, you brought up a subject, Mothman, and they made a movie about this. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen the movie, but it is a subject matter that hit the scene, was really out there, and people were just talking about it, and then it evaporated.
Mm-hmm.
What is Mothman, for those of my listeners that are not aware of what Mothman is, and why was Mothman so ominous?
Well, yeah, I mean, if you think of the word Mothman, you know, it kind of sounds cartoonish, like Batman or Spider-Man or something like that. But the reality is actually very different. That was essentially like a media term that was created to, you know, deal with the sightings in the town. And it's, you know, it's certainly become a legendary name, so to speak, or term. But the reality is that Mothman was very different. It, again, kind of like the Men in Black, it was described as this dark, shadowy figure that was, the best way you can describe it is something like a gargoyle, like a man-type figure with these large bat-like wings, a very dark, shadowy skin, and again, like some of the MIB reports, having these self-illuminated, glowing red eyes. And it would lurk in the shadows, in the woods, and in some of the older parts of the town of Point Pleasant. And the sightings really began in the latter part of 65. And continued through till December 67. And the sightings really culminated with the collapse of what was called the Silver Bridge in Point Pleasant, which spans the Ohio River. And the bridge collapsed into the river and literally killed dozens of people who were in their cars on the bridge at the time that it collapsed. And various researchers have seen or tied the collapse of the bridge with Mothman's presence. In other words, you know, it was either the cause of the event, like a Grim Reaper type character, or other people view Mothman as sort of like a warning entity, you know, that turns up when disasters are about to happen and tries to warn people of impending doom, if you like. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting is that when the Mothman sightings were at their height, encounters with the Men in Black were also sort of all over Point Pleasant. People were getting similar things to Albert Bender, like telephone interference and strange noises and weird electronic bleeps on the phone. Other people had seen Mothman were getting visitations from Men in Black late at night, or they'd see them sort of lurking at the end of their driveway, you know, under a full moon or whatever. And even a local journalist in town, Mary Heyer, She began reporting in the local newspapers about the Mothman and UFO sightings in the area. And she talked about how she got a couple of visits from the Men in Black. One eerie experience late one night where this curious guy came into the offices and started asking her questions about had she been told not to talk about flying saucers and what would she do if she was threatened not to talk and, you know, almost again like veiled intimidation. And sure enough, when the Mothman sightings pretty much came to a halt in December 67, the Men in Black went away as well. So somewhere along the line, there seems to clearly have been a connection suggesting that it's not just strictly UFOs that the Men in Black turn up to silence people with respect to. It's also more, I guess you could call paranormal-based stuff like the Mothman as well.
You also, in your book, and again, chronologically, you follow a patterning of stories and documented references and all of this. You talk about the Men in Black, MIBs, mm-hmm. in the new millennium, but you also talk about women in black. So that was something that was a surprise because it's always been the focus on the Men in Black.
Yeah.
Tell us about the women in black.
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly we don't have as many reports on record of the women in black, but, you know, people ask me, does that mean there aren't as many cases? I'm not sure it may be that they're just not as well reported because possibly people may not make the distinction because they're not thinking about women in black. You know, they may not realize that they've actually had a visit from someone related to the Men in Black because, you know, it doesn't fit the standard mode that people think of. But I have a whole chapter on this in the book where, you know, people have said that they were dabbling in paranormal stuff or, you know, had seen a UFO and they would get visitation or they had visitations from women in black or a woman in black. And the interesting thing is that the women are described very, very similar to the men. They're often or usually dressed in like a woman's typical black business suit, but they also have sort of the very white porcelain-like skin, very unemotional, enigmatic, and also kind of exuding a feeling of unease or creating a feeling of unease in the witness. And I mean, in the book, I talk about one case from Puerto Rico where a farmer who I interviewed in 2005 when I was on Puerto Rico doing a Chupacabra expedition, I went with a friend of mine named Paul Kimball from a film company in Canada called Red Star Films, and we were out there making a documentary for one of the Canadian TV channels, and we interviewed a rancher who his animals had been attacked by what was believed to be a Chupacabra, and then the following day after the attack, this man and woman in black, like a pair of them, turned up and started questioning him and grilling him, you know, about the nature of the events. And he said that both the woman and the man were sort of very emotionless, cold, very much kind of in his face, so to speak. And the weird thing was, you know, it was Puerto Rico in the summer. It was, you know, 100 plus degrees. And they were there sort of fully dressed in black business suits. Pretty much walking through the fringes of the rainforest, you know, to the man's front door. And he didn't see any car or anything like that. And the woman actually asked most of the questions. And he said that when they were apparently satisfied with the answers, they just didn't even say goodbye. They just turned and walked straight off, pretty much, you know, down the old winding road to the major part of the rainforest, you know, as if they were just sort of going to walk into the forest, literally, which again is sort of a very bizarre scenario. But, you know, everything about the men in black or the women in black is pretty bizarre, really.
You also go into an aspect of time travelers.
Yeah.
And this is something movies have been made about through the years. There's a fabulous movie. I don't know when it was done. It was maybe in the 30s or 40s. But it's just, there's so many that have been done through the years. But they are always a machine, a mechanism that enables you to alter dimensional time, and it enables you to go from point A to point B. And I know that in this section, you talk about Jim Pennington, and he was with the U.S. Air Force, and he believes, interestingly enough, and I'm going to quote it directly from your book, that UFOs are piloted by future humans. Now, tell us about Pennington. Because this isn't someone that has come out of a mental hospital. This is someone that has had actual experiences, especially overseas. So let's talk about him for a moment.
Yeah, sure. Well, Jim Peniston was someone who was involved in a very famous, probably Britain's most famous ever UFO case in a place called Rendlesham Forest in December 1980. There was a British Royal Air Force base, or twin bases, called Bentwaters and Woodbridge. And at the height of the Cold War, one of them was leased out to the U.S. Air Force. And so there was a U.S. Air Force presence on the east coast of England, you know, in the event of a Soviet attack. And in December 1980, Peniston was one of a number of military personnel who saw strange lights and a strange object in the woods. And, he actually went on record as saying, you know, it was clearly a structured object of some sort that wasn't a helicopter or, you know, an aircraft or anything. It was something definitively, you know, non-human, or that's how it seemed to be. And it was classed as a UFO, which, you know, by all intents and purposes, it was. But when Peniston went under hypnosis, he was able to recall further aspects of the story that had become sort of locked in his subconscious, I suppose. And one of these was that the UFO presence, or part of it at least, wasn't extraterrestrial, but related to people, if you like, the human race far in the future coming back, the reason being that there'd be something had gone wrong in the future with human reproduction, and the species was, you know, in danger of becoming extinct. And so the idea was that they come back to our time and, you know, harvest DNA, etc., to try and save the species in the future, and that they come back a significant amount of time in the past to try and avoid, upsetting timelines. And how this relates to the Men in Black, Peniston's story, that's the basics of Peniston's story. But how it relates to the Men in Black, one of the people I interviewed for the book was a man named Josh Warren, who's a paranormal researcher in North Carolina. And Josh, you know, said, or identified, and quite rightly, you know, the Men in Black, they dress out of fashion and out of time. They drive old cars. And he wondered, you know, could it be they're somehow connected, they're time travelers, you know, coming back to ensure that these sort of timelines are kept intact and there are no sort of time paradoxes, you know, where by coming back into the past that they don't inadvertently kill someone, so it upsets the future timelines, you know. And Josh wondered, and it's an interesting theory, you know, could it be that there's something about the future where they don't have a full understanding or knowledge of our history or our presence and their history, so to speak. And so maybe they're kind of 20 or 30 years out with the clothing and the cars, not really realizing it, you know. And it's an interesting theory, the idea that, you know, they could be time travelers rather than extraterrestrials.
Fascinating stuff. Nick, I know we're just about out of time here. What is your website so people can find out more about your research and your publications and your various shows that you do?
Okay. Well, people can contact me at nickredfernsbooks.blogspot.com. And people can contact me there. I'm always happy to, chat and email with people. And they can also find out about the books and availability and where to get them from, etc.
All right. Would you repeat that one more time? Nick Redfern, which is spelled R-E-D-F-E-R-N, and Nick is N-I-C-K. Nick Redfern Books.
.blogspot.com.
.blogspot.com.
Correct.
Wonderful. Well, Nick, you are a man that gets into some unique and fascinating material. It's a delight having you as a guest again. And just keep on showing what you find out. This is really fascinating stuff. It really makes us aware that there's a lot more going on that we haven't a clue about.
Well, thanks, Donna. Thanks for having me on the show again.
It's been delightful. Donna Sebo here, Nick Redfern. Go to nickredfernbooks.blogspot.com, and you'll find out more information. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break, and we're going to be back in just a moment.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature. However, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. What a fascinating guest. Lots of unique things going on this in this world of ours, and I want to take this opportunity to thank those of you that stopped by to say hello. The Renaissance Fair here in Washington is finished, and boy, we had record numbers of people coming out. I was telling our engineer, it's the first time in 12 years that I've been doing this event that we had perfect weather every single weekend, and today it's raining. That's really something here in the Pacific Northwest. Usually we have storms or something hit when we're doing this, but that's not the case. We had beautiful, beautiful weather, and I want to thank the staff there at the Renaissance Midsummer Fair because it was just incredibly well done. Everybody had a great time, and it is something that is an annual event that is unforgettable. So new site, record numbers of people. We just had a blast. Donna Sebo here. If you'd like to call in and chat with me, I'd be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. Here's the toll-free telephone number for you to call into, 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And all I need from you is your first name or your initial. Of course, I love to know where you're calling in from. And then after that, you're welcome to ask me about anything that you like. Quick rundown on the guests that we have this week. We're going to be talking with Felicity Okto. Her story is an amazing one. We'll be talking to her in England tomorrow. This woman has a mission. Her book is titled, It's My Life and I'm in Charge. Her story is something that I think every woman should hear, so I encourage you to listen. And then we've got Dr. Richard Gentry. Raising Confident Readers. We are starting to get back into school with kids pretty soon, and I think that this is an exceptionally important subject for just about anybody, especially when they're at their formative years. You want to encourage them to love what they do. Then on Friday, we're going to be talking about the cosmic internet. Frank DeMarco is going to be my guest. And then on Friday, we'll be talking about Fit, Fun, and Fabulous with Dr. Hartford. And this can be at any age, and I can tell you that's the truth. So that's our lineup for this week. If you want to find out who else is coming up on the show, all you have to do is tap the button that says Show Information. You'll see a little bit of a write-up about each one of the guests that I have coming on, and you'll find out what's happening. Coffee. Oh, my goodness. It's a staff alive for so many people, isn't it? I mean, around the world, coffees are really something. Well, I had no idea because I'm a tea drinker. I had no idea about the cost of coffee, and I'm sure it's going up, depending on where it comes from and who's putting it out there. But there was a comment made that the price of gas has gone up so much, and people are complaining about that, but they said fueling with coffee can be four times as expensive as buying a gallon of gas. It's hard to wrap your mind around that one. Now, here are some examples of what coffee costs, about 12 ounces worth. Now, some of the coffees brewed at home, others are bought already brewed, and these are average prices. So this is what it is. For Millstone-tested Colombian coffees, now these are the coffees that are already packaged. You buy them at your grocery store or wherever you get them. 33 cents per 12 ounces. And Ethiopian coffees, 72 cents per 12 ounces. Starbucks Via Ready Brew Colombia is a whopping $1.24 per 12 ounces. Tested Colombian K-Cups, those cute little things that you use for one cup of coffee, $1.31 for 12 ounces. Starbucks Brewed, straight coffee, no lattes here, $1.50. And Dunkin' Donuts, $1.69 per 12 ounces. Amazing stuff. So I just thought I'd share that with you. Who would ever imagine? But coffee is just something that, as far as we know in recorded history, it has always been something that many, many people have enjoyed. And I'll share a fun story with you about coffee. When my husband and I were visiting, in Russia in 1992, we were on a tour through the Summer Palace in St. Petersburg, which, by the way, if ever you have the chance to visit that glorious country, I would encourage it. The art and beauty there is just breathtaking. So the tour guide was taking us through certain sections of the Summer Palace and was talking about Catherine the Great. Catherine was a woman who was up early hours in the morning, long before many of her staff were, and she would start working and reviewing papers and all kinds of things. Well, on one occasion, there was someone that wanted to know what she was doing, a visitor from another country, an ambassador, and he went in to visit her, and she gave him permission to do that, obviously, and he noticed that she had been served this little cup of coffee. And he said, oh my goodness, the coffee, you've got some coffee there. She said, yes. And she said, would you like to have a cup? And he said, is this how you start your day? She said, yes, I start. I have one cup of coffee every morning. He said, okay. So he went and asked for a cup of coffee, and they fixed it exactly the same as they did for Catherine the Great. He took a few sips and went, whoa, and passed out. He did not know that that one cup of coffee was made from 1 pound of coffee beans. That was a Red Bull special, but not in the way we've got it today. I mean, it was unbelievably loaded with caffeine. Can you imagine taking 1 pound of coffee and brewing it into one cup of coffee? Your hair would stand on end just whiffing it. Anyway, I just think that's a little bit of fun trivia. Okay, we're coming into the school year. And I don't know about you, but there's always, it seems like, a class that you have to take. And for those of us that don't have a chance to sit into a classroom very often, and you find yourself going through this learning curve, and it's frustrating, and you wonder how you can get back in touch with it, well, I have some tips for you that I will share. And I just think that this is good for anybody. Now, if you have kids, and these kids are, you know, they've enjoyed their summer, and they've now got to buckle down and really, you know, I should say buckle up and settle down to doing studying. Well, there is a quantum learning network, and there's a guy by the name of Bobby DePorter, and he has decided that he wanted to train teachers to teach how to study. And everything regarding study habits can really help the adult as well as the young students. And he said, you know what, the biggest thing is to be away from distractions. don't have the television on, especially with kids, but even with adults. You need to have a place where you're not going to have a whole bunch of distractions. If you're going to study, find out when you can do it. And I know of a woman, when she's going to her business classes, she always tries to set a time where she doesn't have her family around. Sometimes she goes to the library. Whatever it is, she's got to be in that modality where she's not going to be interrupted, so her family understands that. So she sets certain parameters, and that works for her. But you need to focus on one thing at a time when you're trying to study. So you need to create an environment for you that is going to work. Now, maybe your style is not sitting still. So what you want to do is find out what works for you. I know of someone that whenever she's working on a project, she's working with a computer, she sits back, she's sprawled back in this chair. It's amazing to me. I don't know how she can do it. But she's got a portable board, and her computer is in front of her, but she says she's comfortable. It's sort of like being in a large recliner, and she just does whatever she needs to do. This is the way she likes to work. Other people prefer to work in other manners. So every one of us have our own particular style. And you need to remember, music can help you a great deal when you're studying. If you play Bach, Handel, Pachelbel, Vivaldi, it's a fascinating thing that they've studied. When you are listening to that music, it's classical music, but when you have it playing in the background, very low, it creates a stimulus for the mind. It enables you to be relaxed and alert at the same time. And also, one of the things that quantum learning likes to enforce is positive affirmations. And especially with young kids, they need to know that they can learn things. So you want to be sure that this is something you do for yourself as well as an adult. Set your time and be aware that this is an adjustment period. After summer, after a lot of fun activities, kids having to get back into their normal rhythm. We adults sometimes signing up for classes, having to get back in a normal rhythm, plus dealing with our working environments, our families, and all of this. Just a couple of tips there to share with you so that maybe you're going to be able to enjoy the process of studying. So keep the distractions down. Have music in the background that's very soothing, very comfortable, that allows your mind to be relaxed and alert at the same time. And have your environment so that it is comfortable for you, whatever your style might be, to enable you to study more efficiently and effectively. Donna Sebo here. We're going to be taking a break for just a moment. Give me a buzz if you'd like for me to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. 888-627-6008. That's the toll-free worldwide number. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. I'll be back in just a moment.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedrose accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny that will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebo, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, delphiinternational.com. To see more details, God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604 or outside of Pierce County, 800-872-8852.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-627-6008. Wolfgang Sachs is quite a guy. He is just a man that really is involved in the environment and energy. He lives in Germany. He is a man that loves to deal with creating change. And this is something that he said that I thought you might enjoy sort of starting your week off with. He says, beyond a threshold, things become thieves of time. Goods need to be selected, bought, set up, used, experienced, maintained, tidied away, dusted, repaired, stored, and disposed of. Even the most beautiful of objects and the most valuable of interactions gnaw away at our time, the most restricted of all of our resources. As a consequence, we have become poorer in time as we become richer in things. Scarcity of time has thus turned out to be the nemesis of affluence. Yet the full value of things can only be enjoyed when they're given attention. They have to be properly used, adequately enjoyed, and carefully cultivated. So poverty of time degrades the richness of goods. Frugality, therefore, is a key to well-being. I really think Wolfgang has some good points there, but I don't think he's against having nice things in life. What I think, too, there is another side. I don't know about you, but sometimes there are so many things that we have to take care of that we just find ourselves feeling like we're spinning in circles. And every once in a while, I wake up to the fact that I have to just stop and block out time where maybe I don't do anything. How about you? Have you ever felt like that? It's amazing how we keep pushing ourselves. Absolutely keep pushing ourselves. We live in a time where everything seems to have such a momentum of urgency. Maybe that's the word I'll use. And what I find for me works, one, is meditation, which I recommend to anyone. But two, being aware that multitasking sometimes can create confusion for yourself. So if you can set off with some priorities, and if you're a list maker like I am, you might have 25 things on your list for the day. Well, reality may tell you you're only going to get to 3. So don't get upset with yourself. Reprioritize. Put yourself into a different direction. But timing with people, taking time with people that really mean something to you, taking time to be with yourself, to enjoy who you are, to take a deep breath, inhale to 4, exhale to 6, and just make it okay that you're where you are right at this moment, and you're really okay. You really are fine. We get so anxious that anxiousness can actually weave a tangled web for us mentally, where we're not resourceful, where we're not doing problem solving. So I have found, I'm sure like you or many other people have found, sometimes the best way to get your tangled, anxious, busy mind so that it will shut up and not drive you nuts is to do something that is a no-brainer. It can be anything from scrubbing a floor to washing a window to doing laundry. You know, those things that really aren't going to require a lot of thinking. It's marvelous. It really is. It really helps you to get centered. So take time. I know we're winding down after the summer months, and we're going into a very dynamic period of the year. And if you're like me and you're just looking at your calendar and going, holy Joseph, how am I going to get anything else in? Take a deep breath. Inhale to 4. Hold it a second. Exhale to 6. And just know you're going to be just fine. I have some whimsical things that I wanted to share with you that I came across. I always like these odd little tidbits. One isn't so whimsical. One is about in hidden fish. Now, that may sound a little strange. It really is strange. I have a lot of empathy for customs officials when they're dealing with people because if they're checking things out, and we're not talking about narcotics, you can have all kinds of problems. There was a woman that had flown in from Singapore into the Melbourne airport, and she was arrested. And what happened is that the customs officers were hearing these strange flipping and flapping noises from the vicinity of her waist. And this was not a big woman. Well, they had her step off to the side. They checked her out. And I've got a picture of this in front of me. She had 51 live tropical fish in 15 water-filled bags. That's right. 51 tropical fish, 15 water-filled bags attached to an apron that had been ingeniously designed so that she could have this underneath her skirt. Now, could you imagine sitting on a plane with all of that stuff flip-flopping and sloshing around? Holy Moses. Well, they found her out. And, of course, so many places, I think of Hawaii, when I used to fly to Hawaii, they would check people consistently because they'd try to smuggle in snakes. They would do all kinds of stuff. And, of course, the islands of Hawaii had to endure a lot of things that people brought in hundreds of years ago that have not really helped the environment. Everything from the mongoose to the rat and to the mosquito to much, much more. So it's really amazing what people will do. So that's one thing. But what I got a kick out of is this invisible bar that I heard about. Now, there is a town that is titled Nothing. I'm not kidding. That's really its name, Nothing. It has exactly four people in it, and all that was really there was a gas station, and this was on Highway 93 between Phoenix and Las Vegas. Well, there was a man that decided to add something special. He decided he was going to build an invisible bar. This is not a joke. This is true. Drivers cannot see the bar in daylight because the building is camouflaged by thousands of light bulbs, which makes it look like glitter in the Arizona desert. They can see the light, but people assume it's the sun's reflection. My question is, why build an invisible bar? And does anybody ever really stop there? If it looks like a mirage, they're probably just going to pass it by. I wonder where the rest of the story is with this. Donna Sebo here. I know that we're just about out of time. Don't forget, tomorrow we are going to be talking with a woman in England. It's my life and I'm in charge. You're going to need to tune in to find out about Felicity and her story and what she has done to change some things in England that really were not of much concern to people prior to her having gone through the experiences she's gone through. So I hope you'll join us. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. This is your life. Enjoy it. Live it. You're one of a kind. There's no one else like you. And how very, very fortunate that is, because it's your uniqueness that makes your light brighter than you could ever imagine. Be an inspiration. Be the best you can be. And let other people know their light can shine as brightly as yours. Donna Sebo here. Have a fabulous day. Talk to you tomorrow. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.